Great.
Okay, we're going to start off today with a little bit of informality rather than the usual kind of heaviness, especially since we're going to close with death. I thought it was nice if we started out with something a little lighter weight. So I'm going to do the car presentation today.
We're going to have a volunteer.
I have a metaphor that came to me this morning.
You do?
Yeah.
Yes?
I realized that my mind is a bubble machine. It was like a bubble machine.
Would you like to elaborate on that one time?
Okay, an analogy.
You have Lawrence Bolt playing in
the background. And here's a bubby.
I have all these great ideas that are so beautiful, and then they come around and then they come.
Well, now we know what your theme song is, too. Okay.
So I'll just throw that out.
Hey, good. Put it with the compostable.
Kai, there's a computer program called Bubble Sort. You may want to talk to me about it after class.
Oh. I'm not too serious about it yet.
Well, I'm not too serious about Bubble Sort either, but you might need to know to flesh out your metaphors.
To what?
Yes, let's get to it. Before we see the cards, I have here all these which now seem rather serious.
Let's take notes. Oh, note time.
We write down everywhere.
She's more.
These notes seem a little bit serious now in the context of how the morning goes, but I'll give it to you anyway.
Whether
you want it or not, you can all go boo. Well, there probably is a connection, but we won't talk about it. However, we will talk about the connection between cars and sex. But
I'm always wanted to get to this discussion. Oh,
I'm done.
Okay, first of all,
this session
a couple bits of trivia. When do you think the first car was made?
1924.
Not you.
No idea.
Kai.
1907, May.
You probably know the answer.
What's your definition of car?
1880s.
I was going to say 1891.
1889. It was in France.
1888. Anyone want to go 1872?
How do you define a car?
A car? Oh! Okay, excellent. A car is a self-propelled mechanical vehicle for the transportation of humankind or goods.
So a locomotive is a car.
Pardon? Self-empowered.
Well, without tracks. So,
wait, you mean a bicycle?
A chair? No, because it's not self-propelled.
A paddle boat.
A paddle boat does not go on the ground. Come on. Something that goes on a road without tracks.
Jeez.
We give up. Win.
1768.
Oh.
It was, of course, steam-driven. Also, does anyone know when the first internal combustion engine was actually designed?
People are less willing to guess
this. 1890. Anyone else want to try again?
1500.
Well, it's getting closer. Actually, it was 1628 that the internal combustion engine was designed. Not gasoline, for alcohol, actually, because they didn't have gasoline then. But it wasn't actually engineered until about... What did you say, Theo?
What a waste.
That's normal.
I think I'm going back into the shower. I don't know what I rushed out to do this morning.
For Theo and Todd's performance.
That's what it was. Okay. I'm going to try and be serious here.
The lecture process is not as successful as we thought.
No, it's not. I think it's too late. Everyone sort of passed the median point. All right. What are cars used for?
To get to the shopping center.
Yeah, I know that. But what else are cars used
in terms
for?
Of
yes.
Status and goals.
How are they used for status?
To show prestige and power and wealth.
Money. Yeah. Okay, that's an image. All right. And prowess, the other thing. Cars are used to show prowess.
What's prowess mean?
It means your grand capacity to perform. That could be perform in a status way in terms of a job and money. It could also mean perform in sexual terms. It could be perform in a lot of ways, but performance. All right. One of the things about the car that makes it very special to America is that it is, in fact, a much bigger part of the American scene, despite the fact the car was not invented here. The internal combustion engine automobile was invented in Europe. Does anyone have any idea where?
France.
Louis Chevrolet.
Louis Chevrolet was not the person who actually
The Mercedes guy?
That's German, and that wasn't for a while, though he was one of the first. Peugeot and Renault were two.
Renault, yes.
Those are the two guys who did it first. Anyway, all these little bits of trivia. Let's see, what else can I tell you about it? The car in America is inexorably linked to the sexual revolution, which is probably one of the reasons why it is used as such an important sexual tool. But as a metaphor for all that, there is something else that happens to all of us when we're in the car. This is reminding me when I used to be in nightclubs and sort of be singing and no one was listening. At exactly the wrong places, right?
Uh-huh.
This is a lot of fun.
Do you want to talk more about this word?
I'm beginning to feel like I don't want to, but I made these notes, so damn it, you're going to hear what it has to say.
Come on, everybody be quiet. I want to hear what happens to us, everyone, while we're in the car.
We feel power.
Only in a bus.
You can fit in the back seat.
We're having fun.
It's different. It depends on
Lori, what happens when you're in a
Does it depend if it's in a VW or a...
Not all, but almost all.
Lisa, would you mind just lowering yourself?
Did you get shorter? In the early 1820s in England, they decided that what they wanted to do was to have trackless railways, and so they had these carriages that would go from town to town at a rapid speed of about 4 miles an hour. And in fact, they were considered to be so dangerous that they would have a law called the Red Flag Law, which meant that the only way that they would operate is if somebody could walk in front of them carrying a red flag. So they really didn't go terribly fast or terribly popular.
Why were they dangerous?
They were considered to be dangerous. They were because they were new technology. Because people were afraid of them. And actually, if you saw these things chugging down a country road, you'd be pretty afraid of it too. It made an incredible racket. It belched terrible smoke. And off it went. Because this is about 1820-something. And they had all these steam carriages going back and forth around the English countryside near
London. And that ran on alcohol?
These ran on wood, because they're steam. This is another one of them.
Oh, good grief.
This thing is made out of cast iron. So you can imagine what this looks like, rolling down a gorgeous little British country lane.
Get out of mud.
The problem. Those weren't invented until the
school. What are these saying now about the people?
Well, I think it may be saying quite a bit about the people. What do you think it's saying?
Oh, God.
I mean, by today's standards, and you look at that, what do you think it's talking about?
Rich.
Rich? Okay, what else?
Elegant.
Gypsy. Elegant, yeah, that's definitely elegant.
Trying to be elegant.
Daring. It hasn't. Thank you. Cars weren't used for, like, speed and sort of excitement. Type thing that I think cars are used for now.
Right, they were
merely much more placid.
They were parlors.
Yes.
There were ways of just sort of sitting in a little parlor, sipping a bit of sherry, and sort of getting somewhere at the same time. They were merely transportation. So if you look at this thing, you notice there are hardly any windows in it. Here it is made out of wood and cast iron, and everybody inside is sort of in darkness. The cheaper... Pardon me?
feet inside, 22 outside.
This is 1820s in England. Nothing happens. Above, you see where the people paying the cheaper seats sit.
Cheaper? That's
covered with dust and smoke and soot. Having a gay old time scaring the sheep.
That holds a windy now.
Scaring the sheep.
This is one of the more elegant varieties. In fact, this particular one, there it says 5 miles per hour on the level, so going uphill with something else. This particular one, I believe, was built for a duke of some kind, as sort of a play toy. It was used only once or twice and then went to a museum somewhere. Question?
Up at the top there, it says it consumed 66 pounds of coke an hour. What does that mean?
Coke was a product of coal. Which was a liquid kind of fuel, and it would burn it. So I guess it meant that it burned that much an hour to operate.
5 miles.
Horizontal twin cylinder engine.
That would be true.
Aren't these really nice little guys?
Boy, that's kind of like.
Is this your collection of cars?
My collection? Yes, I have them on Vashon. We're looking at it's not quite an internal combustion engine. I think it's a small steam-driven. You can see the cylinder up there. But it's still that carriage idea. Also, you might realize that many of the new cars had the engines in the front, although it was actually considered much more efficient to have them in the back. In fact, the first Renault and Peugeots had the engines in the back, but people wanted the engines in the front, ultimately. Does anyone know why?
See them.
No. Although that was certainly, they were covered up usually. They were there because that's where the horses were. Of course.
Kidding.
Oh, nope. That's really
weird. That's really what they were doing there. Weird. So technology certainly starts reflecting other things in this process. Now we're getting into the internal combustion. So now you see there are little carriages. Carriages without the horses.
Baby carriage.
So, yes. Question.
Where does Henry Ford come into all of this?
And these are, we haven't gotten to America yet.
Okay, but is this at the same time as America?
These are much earlier than Henry Ford. Let me get my... Yes, that. This particular one that we're looking at right now is a Peugeot. 3.5 power. This is from 1897.
It says 1892 on the license plate,
no, whatever. Yeah, but it says 1897 in the book. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I'm reading the wrong line. 1890. This is the Peugeot. This is one of Peugeot's first guys.
Oh, it's a Peugeot.
Pardon me?
It looks like a Peugeot. Sorry.
Okay. Here's the Peugeot. Peugeot and Peugeot.
Wicker.
Wicker, yes. Many of the original tires were solid rubber and were so heavy and hard that they had to build the bodies themselves out of something that would take the rattling. And so often they would build them out of flexible materials like bamboo and wicker instead of sheet metal. They didn't invent the tube tire, the hollow tire, for another 10 years. So suspension was a real problem with these guys. Peugeot's the guy who invented the spoked wheel for the automobile.
Oh, really?
Which saved the weight and gave them a little more durability.
Is that because there's space between the horses now?
This is a Didion Populaire from 1903, a lovely little creature. You'll notice they still are pretty much reflecting the idea of wagons and carriages. Who were the cars made for at this particular time? The rich. They were toys. They were not considered to be anything of any great significance. They were just there to sort of scare a few horses and have a good time tooling around the countryside and getting dusty. Yes?
Was it also for prestige, for those who were rich?
Well,
besides just being a toy?
I think that you're right, that a lot of people had them because they wanted to be the first one on in their earldom to run around.
Just like we want.
Like having a Lear jet.
This is my favorite one.
Wow.
This is another Renault. This is what they call the Type X. It was one of the last of its breed, and it has a brass body. So it was. Isn't it a real handsome vehicle? The Type X, this is the 1907. It's one of the first cars with tube tires.
Now, how much would like an all rubber tire weigh?
Gosh, I don't know, but it would weigh a lot because it's real dense stuff.
Oh, okay.
Depends how big it is.
Thank you, Pat. Let's move on. This is obviously it has some similarities. This is a Lancaster from 1908. This is a British version. The British started early to reproduce what the French were doing, but they never quite got the hang of it. In fact, they still have that problem. For those of you who have ever owned a British car realize that they are the most idiosyncratic beasts in the entire universe. But somehow people love them anyway. I guess it's sort of like liking the underdog.
But it looks like it has a chauffeur in front.
Yes. Since all of these were essentially built for the rich, that was often what they had. They were either chauffeur-driven, or they were tooling around cars for the people who wanted to get down and dirty, you know, once a month.
Like Toad in Wind in the Willows.
Like Toad in Wind in the Willows. Very good. This is one of my favorite cars. This is a G.P. Austin from 1908 and was the first car to do 100 miles per hour.
Wow.
It is a racing car. You will notice the number one on the side. Cars were being used for the rich people to race as early as 1899. There was, in fact, many cross-Europe car races that included England, and this is sort of one of the first starts of the whole thing. And once again, now that people started playing around with the automobile, it left the realm of the military and went into the hands of the rich, which, quite frankly, are usually the same people, but just different parts of their lives. The G.P. Austin. Another racing car from 1911. This is the Bedettia. At about this time in automobile history, it was the Italians that took over a lot of the excitement when it came to automobile design, and quite frankly, I think they never surrendered it. Although this one looks a little bit clunky, you'll notice it looks very much like an airplane body. Those of you remember what old biplanes look like. Airplane technology and automobile technology were going side by side. In fact, many of the first airplane manufacturers also produced the first automobiles.
It's like you could almost pedal it.
Yeah, it certainly has that quality about it. Okay, what is the basic difference between this car, the way you look at it, the way some of the other ones look? Anyone sort of want to? Are the engine still in the front? That's the radiator in the front.
It's
there.
All, the body's all one piece, or not one piece, but it's kind of smooth and together instead of having the engine, the compartment.
It doesn't look so much like a
carriage. Oh, it's a
two-seater. Okay, it's a two-seater. But the other thing about it is that you notice it doesn't have all the usual embellishments. It has wooden spoke tires. This is not a car of the super rich. This is the car of the upper middle class. So consequently, it is there more of a, this is probably more utilitarian car. This particular one is called the Leslie Horsfield Trojan. So it was a workhorse kind of car more than anything else. It still isn't the kind of everyman car. But cars are beginning now to be played with, this is in 1912, by people who are not the super rich. So just in the course of 15 years, a play toy of the rich has become the status symbol for the middle class. This is hardly a middle class car, but it's the same date as the other one. This is another Renault. This is another one of my favorite cars. It is such an incredibly clunky vehicle.
Look at all the different shapes in that, though.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Real interesting design. Real strange combination of aerodynamicness and non-aerodynamicness.
Looks like a joke.
It has humor in it, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they saw the humor exactly, but certainly by our standards, it has humor. Yeah, this is one of my favorites. This is also a 1912 Chenard Walker Racing vehicle.
Every car is one of his favorites.
Did I say something funny?
You sure did.
Good, I'm glad. Tell me about it. Nice color, huh? I love that bump back. Strange shape. Notice all the fuel sort of on the side there. They didn't have gas stations every corner or so. Yes.
You know how they refer to cars as women at the time?
As what?
As women, because they're kind of curvy. It seems like this is the first one that's starting to get a little bit more curvy.
Is that the only reason they refer to cars as women? Just because they're curvy?
I don't know.
modes of transportation.
Are they delicate? Is that why? Why else do you think we may talk about cars?
She said it.
Christine said it.
What did she say?
They're temperamental.
You can control
them. David. David gets the gold cigar here. What David said, for those of you who didn't hear it, cars traditionally, although that has changed over the years, have been operated and owned by what sex person?
Men.
And what do you do in a car that makes it so amazingly fun is control it. That's my personal belief, and several other people, in fact, as to why cars are generally named women, by women's names. In fact, we'll talk about that issue of control as we move into the future. This is another Peugeot.
One of your favorites.
This is not one of my favorites.
It's mine.
It's sort of interesting. I just think it's still beautiful.
The gold and the green is nice.
We have just bumped into America. This is one of the first Fords. This is the Ford T Coupe. And what do we see about this car now is it looks very much more like an everyman car. They're all black. They're very lightweight in appearance. They're very simple in design and model, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's all closed in, not very many of the other ones.
Okay, right, it's all closed in. I mean, those, you didn't want to get dusty as you drove off to your insurance salesman's job.
Is this American, though?
Pardon me?
Yes, he said before.
Yes, this is an American car. Henri Ford. Narrow American car.
Ah, Dearborn, Michigan.
1922. This is one of those wonderful cars that looks like if you were a fairly new gangster, you might have this one. You're not rich enough to have the real flashy one, but it still has that the machine gun sort of quality hanging out the window there. This is a Nash Chrysler. It's hard to believe that Nash and Chrysler were two guys who actually made a car together. But they did, and this is what they made, among others. 1922 car. It's a real nice little everyday car. You'll notice now that the concept of the parlor is beginning to come back again. As the middle class inherited the automobile, the middle class also inherited a lot of the pretensions of what they saw the automobile as having been in the past. And one of the things it was a living room on wheels. So, yes?
In cars, I went with a friend to an antique car show, and they have little vases.
Uh-huh. Flower vases.
Flower vases in the back seat. They're weird. Up on the walls.
So basically what we're noticing is there are just a few different kinds of approaches to the automobile. One is the sort of down and dirty part of like racing vehicle, which is more like the technology, involved in the technology. The other one has to do with the parlor on wheels, more of a status sort of thing. And the third function is utilitarianism, which I might add is primarily an American function of the automobile. Is that a question, Brent?
Those white walls, or is that just the picture?
Those are white rubber tires.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. I have no idea if those are the original equipment, but this is an old photograph. So
the French have one.
What they used to do with rubber in those days, by the way, is paint them. The idea of white wall tires sort of happened after people realized that the paint kept flaking off their tires after a while. Isn't this a neat guy? This is a Massey from 1923. It is a French vehicle designed by a Volt builder, which shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone, as a racing vehicle. I think it's really funny that it's sort of got the aerodynamic part on the end. I wondered if it went backwards, but I doubt it. Anyway, this particular car was about to win its race when one of its wheels fell off, and it struggled to get there on three wheels at the end, and the guy didn't want to stop. Yes?
My cousin, who's an engineering student up at UW, said it really doesn't matter if the grill is aerodynamic. You want to have the pointy thing at the end like that. That actually is more dynamic. It doesn't matter about the grill.
Right, so it stops the turbulence in the back from kind of sucking you back. Yeah. That's why a teardrop probably has the shape it does. Mm-hmm. All right, from SA. 1923 again. This is a Renault as well. The banana, yes. The great French banana. This particular slide wasn't labeled, but I bet it's got to be a French car of some kind. It's also a racing vehicle, but they're playing around. One of the things about the racing in Europe at this time is they weren't just sort of Indianapolis 500. Sometimes they would last for months. And the French weather is notorious for its rain, so that's why this is an enclosed racing vehicle. So they're not only just to get there fast, they're also to get there with the driver alive and not suffering from the flu, and still for endurance as well. Really racing cars. Isn't this an interesting guy? This is a Bugatti from 1923. It looks more like a tank than anything else. But
what year?
1923. Bugatti. The Bugatti brothers built the racing cars for the rich folks in Italy. From the sublime to the ridiculous. This is actually another Italian car that was built for people. This is a Fiat, an early Fiat. Fiat 520, in fact, from 1928.
This is the actual size.
What'd you say, Kyle?
Nothing.
I always miss the jokes.
They aren't really jokes.
I'll tell you, wrote the joke for you.
Oh, yeah.
This is kind of like.
Anyone want to guess what this one is?
Mercedes!
Yeah, I wonder how you figured that one out. One of the ways you can always tell whether it's a car for the rich is to notice just how embellished it is. And despite the fact that this one doesn't have a lot of arabesques on it, notice those wonderful fenders and how different those fenders are from the fenders of the Ford cars.
Look like German helmets.
Nice shapes.
Real nice kind of shapes. The running board over there, the trunk on the side.
Tell, it looks very German.
It's a convertible as well.
Oh,
rumble seats.
Yeah, the rumble seat. That's right. This is a Bentley. This is a British car. But once again, you have those flares on on the fenders. Real nice sort of things. Attractive. Do you guys know where the word trunk came from for being able to hold your luggage?
Well, I think, did they?
No. You could probably guess and figure it out, but I'll tell you.
Did they put trunks on the back of their bumper?
That's how they, right. In order to carry luggage, since they had no compartment in the car, they would attach a trunk to the back. And eventually they started building them in, and the name stayed with us. This is one of the best cars ever made. We'll see a couple of these. This is a Hispano Suiza. It's actually a Spanish-Italian car that was designed and built custom for the nobility of Europe. And in fact, they still make Hispano Suizas today.
Wow.
This is the Jean Bugatti Royale from 1932, and that's Jean Bugatti himself right there. Question.
How many V's are these?
How many what?
V's.
Cars? Good question. Yes, these cars are often things like V8s, V10s.
This looks like a V16.
Yeah, they're V16. Excuse me, not V's. I would say they're sometimes 16 cylinders, but they're sometimes straight up. They really hadn't gotten their engineering down. 16 cylinders really wasn't all that terribly efficient, but Rich didn't mind. And it made a lot of noise, too, which I think is something they also enjoyed.
So when does the sex come in?
It's beginning to come in already.
You see?
This is the Jaguar 100.
Yeah.
One of the places that the sex begins to come in is when it really starts becoming a car of the... we can notice it more when it becomes the car that of the middle class. Because we start thinking about power and authority and control. How many people do you know are very different behind the wheel than they are in normal life?
I am
the same way. I'm gentle, mild-mannered, unassuming. But get me behind the wheel. And I think part of what it is what that means to us, not only in terms of sexuality, but also just in terms of how we deal with our lives, how much power we have over our lives and how we really love to have that power. And so this machine provides for us a vehicle, a metaphor for doing that. And then when we start realizing that, at some point we start doing things to the car because the car becomes our alter ego. We'll see that in just a little bit. The last one was a Jaguar, this one is a Fiat.
Also, the hood ornaments are getting more exotic.
Because they're taking more ornamentation off the car.
What? Well, yeah, I think I sort of do, but go ahead and why don't you tell us and I'll see if I'm right.
Fiat, the name Fiat stands for Fix It Again, Tony.
My stepdad said that.
No, that's not what I thought it was.
How about the Chevrolet?
I agree.
Chevrolet.
1930s. Like what happens to the styling as they move into the 30s?
Long.
Okay, they're long, but they're not much longer than they were before.
They're
rounder.
Color is lighter.
Well, color. Actually, color is important because right now color really comes into it more.
High hood.
If this was after the Depression, it would be
much more sleek.
Rounded kinds of forms. They are also contained. The fenders are attached to the vehicle as opposed to kind of hovering there in some strange
implication
sort of
way. Movement.
Movement's really important.
And the colors.
The auburn.
The dancing.
The hood ornament.
Church mother.
So in terms of sort of sleek, womanly fastness, I mean, these cars didn't go any faster than the other ones did for the most part. They just looked like they did. This is a Bologna Hispanos. What does it tell you about this car that it has two spare tires in the back?
That they usually drive it out in the middle of nowhere.
There was no other place to drive them.
Oh, wow, that's a little weird. That's a big change.
That's a very, very practical car.
Or a Saab?
Is that a Saab?
Nope, that is not a Saab.
That's a Roadster.
You'll be really surprised to hear what this one is.
A
Citroën.
It is not a Citroën.
Chrysler.
Well, you're getting close. It's a Pierce Arrow.
Oh,
wow.
In fact, this particular Pierce Arrow is right in front of the old Pierce Arrow plant in Buffalo, New York. 1933, this arrow. Pierce Arrow, excuse me.
Mercedes again.
Oh, what a sweetie, what a sweetie. Weird. Isn't that a neat sort of thing? So what's happening now is we see the embellishment that's going on in the 30s is they're all about speed and movement. Think about what the 30s were like in terms of what's happening to the world. Well, okay, there's the Depression, but the Depression doesn't hit the rich very much. In fact, the only people who really suffered from the Depression were the nouveau riche, not the real rich. And so these cars are not for them. These cars are for the real rich. So what we notice, however, is the implication about movement and technology. And if we think about what other movements are going on in the 30s, there is futurism. There is a great deal of hope that technology will be able to save the world. There's a great deal of feeling of industrialization is the tool. So there's a lot of emphasis on the idea of what technology can do and what the future looks like. If we go back to old popular mechanics magazines of the 30s and get their opinions of what the future looks like, you'll see the same kind of designs and shapes you see in the cars. Theo.
Or other things like, what's the style of furniture and, and architecture at this time? What is it classified?
Chrysler Building is being built at this time. Those of you who are familiar with that in New York, which has that same kind of feeling of rounded technology.
Art Deco
is built. Pardon me? Frank Lloyd Wright was, but he was still fairly young. I think that a lot of the things we know about Frank Lloyd Wright have little to do with the technology that we're talking about here. This has to do more with a different kind of philosophical point of view. And actually, it has more to do with geometric Louis Sullivan, which is not about Art Deco designs. There's some Beethoven.
It seems to me that also there's a lot of connection between, like, that white car, the real sleek car, that it ties in a lot with just fashion and, I mean, and the whole social thing with the flappers and the prohibition and all that kind of stuff.
Well, but that was during the 20s, though, the flappers, and it was like, this is after the Depression, so.
Yeah, but it carried over, and not necessarily this car tied in with that, but some of the cars that we saw earlier, real sleek and more concentrated on speed, what you said about they look like they go faster, you don't really, but they look like they do.
Well, it hit a time of delusionment, so I would think that they would get more somber if you don't agree.
Well, but who's really being somberized by the Depression? Not the people who these cars are. The upper classes are rarely affected by that sort of thing.
Good Lord.
Isn't that
an
amazing guy? This is a Lago Calvet from the late 30s. It's a racing car. I kind of jumped up, but isn't that an amazing vehicle?
Wow.
That's I'd love to have a car like that. Anyway, moving right along. Anyone want to guess the kind of a car that looks like?
MGB.
You might think it was an MGB.
Austin
Healey. The Austin Healeys and the MGBs were very much designed after this particular car.
It's a British car.
It's not British. It's a Bugatti. This is an Italian car. Bugatti is the guy who designed a lot of the original cars, one of the original designers of automobiles.
Now we're getting to the cars, guys. PR.
Okay.
Studebaker.
Here we are. There you go. It's a Studebaker. It's a Studebaker Lowry, in fact, from 1946. Of course, no cars were made during the war in the 40s. So when the war was over, all the automobile companies were sort of rushing each other into production to make cars, retooling from planes and tanks into cars. And they realized now that they had a market ready for them. Yes, Theo?
Okay. Well, you said jets and planes into cars. It kind of looks like you can see a jets. They're what they learn when building planes and stuff.
Silly girl
thing. Excellent point. The people who were doing the designing for all of the war machinery are now out of the army and into private industry, and some of the carryover is here. So we see the same kind of feeling. And we also notice that right away, automobiles and women are being associated together.
She can't drive it. She just is going to sit in it until he comes back.
That's right.
He's taking photos.
Look, I've got two of them with me this time.
This is my favorite car of all time. This is the Cord.
It only has two wheels. Three wheels.
It's a car that was designed and built by a American industrialist in Chicago. He felt that he could turn Chicago, which was in an industrial depression at the time right after the war, around and take over the Motor City Lauditz from Detroit. He designed a car that had hydraulic jacks that automatically lifted the car up when you turned it on. It had a central headlight that is hidden in the grill that when you turn the lights on, those on the side automatically open, and the central one follows the steering wheel wherever it goes.
Wow.
He had air conditioning in his car. He had a rear windshield wiper. Wow. He had a lot of other technical innovations, and everyone said, whoa, this is too scary for me, and nobody bought it. He made 100 of them, and they weren't even all that expensive relative to other cars, and he went bankrupt in 3 weeks after production. The Cord is now one of the every bit of technology that he innovated at the time is now being used in cars today.
For the following the headlight.
Right, the headlight would follow the steering wheel.
But that's not used.
Actually, that is used, but only in sort of real exclusive cars. It's not being used in an everyday way. Although I've heard that there's a Saab that is considering coming out with that. Now, it was fairly low, so it couldn't shine in people's eyes. Just like
this tail is fins.
The Cadillac.
Incipient tail fins.
Incipient.
Does it look like an airplane?
Wings.
Fly, look at how they emphasize the sleekness with the white lines.
Drinking. So now, what do we see when we see this car? Power. Cadillacs, by the way. These are special Cadillacs for the very wealthy of the same year.
The hoods are really high.
Yeah, the hoods are very, very high. Okay, this is in fact now you with the kind of car that your parents probably could afford. The Pontiac. Notice how the design is essentially the same, just not quite as big. What year? Sleek, not quite as fast. This is a 1950 Pontiac. And here's another one of my favorites, talking about airplane designs and cars. This is one of the cars that was so ahead of its time that it busted the Studebaker company. But they are so rare now, if you can ever find one of these things, they're worth an incredible fortune, especially if it's a convertible like this one. Very, very beautiful cars, very unique. Just goes to show you that people don't like to get anything that's a little unusual. 1950 is the date on that guy.
Do you think, like, the DeLoreans and things of today will be, like, worth a lot of money in the future?
I really can't speak for that. It's hard to say.
Yeah. But it seems like people do get into the exotic a lot more now.
Like the Avanti, for instance. That's a car that is very much in it.
Yeah, the Lamborghini.
And the Lamborghini.
The little Mellory, how do you want?
Oh.
Corvette, you think so?
It's Italian.
Yeah. What makes it Italian, Kate?
Shape.
Corvette.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, wasn't the Corvette designed in Italy?
The original Corvette was designed in Italy, but they made so many compromises in it by the time they built it in America that it's hardly an Italian design anymore. But anyway, this particular one is, in fact, an Italian car. Anyone want to guess which one it is?
Fiat.
Jay?
Alfa Romeo.
Oh.
That's a nice car.
Yeah, real pretty one. This Alfa Romeo comes from 1952. Most experimental cars like these are much ahead of their time.
Fiat.
Yeah, you got it. This is a 1954 Fiat, my dad. A gas turbine engine when they were first experimenting with it. Has something in common with some of those that 30s cars.
It looks like Speed Racer's car.
This is a racing car.
It looks like an Opel of today.
Sort of. Hey,
that's like
good.
Ugly.
This is a Ford Thunderbird when they started turning them into sedans instead of sports cars. I tried to find a picture of the original Ford Thunderbird, but I couldn't find it in the slide catalog, which is the slide library, which is too bad.
See, I think that shows a lot about the 50s because it got more conservative. I mean, they changed the Thunderbird, which is really a sleek and shapely type car, and they made it all boxed up and straightened out and much more practical.
Yeah. You know why they changed the Thunderbird? They did a lot of research to figure out just exactly who their audience was and what was going to be happening to them, and they determined that the people who bought the Thunderbird were all having families, and getting jobs and nestling down, and so they made a car. They purposely designed the car to fit that need, and that was one of the times when it worked. They also tried to do that with the Edsel, and that's when it didn't work.
It's kind of ironic that now, the last couple of years, the Thunderbird is going back in the sports car.
Yeah, I think that is sort of interesting. Think too, in terms of what you just said, Chris, about the car design reflecting the 50s. How has what's been happening that's consistent with car design in the 50s is car design in the late 70s and 80s. They become boxier, squared off, they become a lot more conservative, not anywhere near as flashy, not really dealing with the sort of passionate side of what some of these other cars, the more flamboyant.
Look, the woman.
Pardon me?
There has a woman in the ad.
Yes, there is a woman in the ad. Wonderful sort of high style 50s clothes, which doesn't at all go with the style of the car, I think.
That
was another story. Oh, there we go. There is, in fact, the original Ford Thunderbird right on top of there. This group of guys. That's a Thunderbird on top, and there's a Mustang down third, and that's a Triumph second, and obviously a Jaguar at the bottom. All these cars, I think, are from this, the camping
scene.
That's a Triumph. Second one. Okay. This is. No, this, in fact, I think, is a Buick. Yep, it's a Buick from 1950.
Oh, I can't wait for the Studebakers.
Okay, now what is happening to cars now?
Family.
Station wagon.
Okay, the practical family station wagon, but what else?
Looks like out west. I mean, the car looks like it needs bull horns tied to the front.
Why?
She's projecting huge boxes.
Are they?
More chrome.
They're big, huge, bulky, all this chrome. What does that mean? What is that saying? What's happening to American economy in 1958?
Everybody's buying stuff.
Big.
Okay, and how do people want to appear then?
Big.
They want to appear wealthy. And what's synonymous with wealth?
Size.
Size. There we go. And that size and chrome trim and all this sort of big clunkiness. I mean, that vehicle looks to me very much like those coaches that we saw from 1820. In terms of its sort of overwhelming
like
size, like the
tank. An ocean liner.
Yet at the same time, people want to have the image of speed, so they throw these nice little movements on the side of chrome, sweeping up and down, which look completely out of place in the design of the vehicle, frankly.
But no matter.
Also, you'll notice that hood ornaments now are very different than they used to be. In the late 50s and 60s, instead of having one hood ornament right at the top, which oftentimes wasn't terribly elaborate, but rather nicely designed, now we see in this Buick it has three hood ornaments. So everything is done in multiples and higher numbers.
The back part looks like an add-on.
Yeah, four doors. Yeah.
In fact, it is an add-on, because the car was designed as a sedan, not as a station wagon.
And you see the whole back end looks like it's kind of like a growth.
What's this one, guys? That's a Cadillac, also from the same year. You'll also notice, too, that when the early cars had long noses and very short backs, and now we're getting shorter noses and very long backs. There's, I suppose, a couple things you could say about that. Part of it is the idea of what the jet planes at the time looked like. But also it's because the luggage compartment is much more important. This is the era when people go on their long car trips with their families, so they need all this luggage space in the back. Okay, this is a very interesting little ad for this particular car. I'm sure you all recognize it as a Chevrolet from 1960.
I'm sure. Oh, yes, I was just gonna say, that's a Chevrolet.
What is this ad and what is this car about?
It's a two-seater.
Okay, it's not a two-seater.
It's not.
Oh, family.
Family car.
It's a family car.
Sporty car.
Okay, where are they showing you this car?
Church.
Front of a church. What are they trying to tell you there?
Marriage. Success. You will be accepted here.
But there is a mixed message in this particular ad.
It's decadence.
So this is... It's a Chevrolet. Chevrolet is a car that most middle-class people could afford. Chevrolet is the car that is the normal car, it's the average car, it's Joe Schmo sort of running around. But now they're doing something to this Chevy.
Add some excitement into your life.
Ah, yes.
It's red.
It's red. And so people are beginning to realize as the 60s come upon us that that there's more to life than just sort of prosperity and nice little families. Now you want to have your families, but you want to have something else too. And the automobile and the automobile advertising at the time begins to reflect some of that. So even your normal cars like Chevrolets and Fords come out with sportier and sportier models. Convertibles are real big at this particular time. Yes, Theo?
Isn't that Blake the airplane on the side? I mean, they're
not... Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would call
design.
That blatant, yes.
Yep. Wow. Speed is getting more and more important.
A Buick.
Oldsmobile.
This comes
it is an Oldsmobile.
Car. It's old 42.
They're not old enough.
There is the lady sort of frolicking on the hood of the yes, Buick.
I think it's interesting that Kai and I had the same idea, what an ugly car, but It's because these cars are the used cars of today. And 15 years from now, we'll look back at this and say, ooh, look at that car.
I don't think we're going to go, ooh, at this particular car. This is sort of the workhorse. So this is my parents' generation car. It's sort of after they played with their Chevy, and now they can afford something a little more fancy. The thing that's interesting about these cars now is that the elaboration is all on the inside, not on the outside anymore. These are the cars that are very plain outside and inside. They all have air conditioning. They all are plush blind. They're beginning to have stereos and stuff like that. This is sort of an interesting ad. I kind of threw this one in just there.
Very similar to some of the ads that we have today.
Powerful businessman,
association of prestige and status and wealth and
okay, this is the Cutlass. And I think that when we think about the car that has to do with real status is that ladies oftentimes are either not alone or not used at all. Sex for advertising doesn't work when you're really talking about the illusion of real wealth. I mean, that's when you have Cesar Romero selling your cars, or what's the guy from Fantasy Island? So they're appealing to an older population. Very different from this Alfa Romeo, which is a kind of sedan car, but still has that beautiful shape, still that Italian kind of design. Of course, many of you will recognize one of the other favorite cars of all time of mine.
All right.
Probably owned a couple of them myself, and someday we'll own another one, I'm sure. Some of the most wonderful cars ever made. The Volkswagen was originally designed in 1932, and essentially had very little change all the way through until the early 60s, when they started changing the engine and changing other things. But the design itself of the bug stayed essentially the same.
And it's for more middle class or anybody kind of car. That's what Volkswagen was.
People's car. Yes, it was a people's car.
Wagon.
All day. Anyway, isn't it a sweetie? I still think they're really beautiful cars. These are the cars that are going to, they're already extremely valuable. If you can find yourself a really good car. This is a 67, which is not the best year. 66 was a real good year.
They didn't change the axle yet.
Yeah, that's right. And they still had the old engine, too.
That's good.
Oh, three-wheeler.
Look at the fins in the back.
This is a Pininfarina. This is designed by Fiat. And this is a three-wheel car, right? It's a car that that kind of three-wheel car, of course, doesn't exist in the States, but they're all over Europe. Those of you who've been there have seen the three-wheel vehicles. They're not particularly stable, but very inexpensive. Anyway, I really like this particular one.
Jag.
Who drives that? Yeah. Classic Jag of the 60s.
It reminds me of the one in Harold and Maude, that one he changed into.
Yeah.
That's a great car.
Changed it into a horse.
This is a Citroën. Also from the 60s. I think it's sort of wonderful how what the difference between a lemon in French and a lemon in English means. They're the people who inherited, this is a Triumph, they're the people who inherited much of the technology of the cord. The Citroën somehow were able to use it effectively and market it. Yeah, somehow that lady and that purse and that car don't quite go together.
This picture was taken on Labor Day.
This picture was taken what?
Nothing. I'm just mumbling. I'm asking Chris to hit
maybe
me in about a minute.
It's obviously a British ad, so what do you expect?
Yeah.
Oh, fine. That's this was the year, I think it, let me check my notes to make sure, I don't remember exactly. And I don't have the exact year. This is the year of the big change when they designed the Stingray. Yeah, and this is the first Stingray car, which I think is the best looking Corvette ever made.
Ooh, bicep.
I really love that.
We're not talking about the
car. I actually didn't even notice
layers.
Great curves. Love those lines.
Those fenders.
Cool.
vendors.
Okay, now.
Right, look under the
Do you have anything to say about this? This bar actually is the Pininfarina Alpha, which was designed in 1966, but is still pretty advanced for its age. It was an experimental car, and this particular one has got all of its things open, so it's really hard to see the lines. And we're looking at it from the back toward the front. So you can see how the two doors kind of open off that that T in the roof. It still has a luggage compartment. It's a small little engine compartment there. Real handsome. I couldn't find a better slide of it, but
that's low and compact.
Very, very low.
Very
low. Yes. You're lying down as you're driving down the street on this one. This is not the car that you have any intimate relationships in. This is, it just says experimental car from the 70s. I have no idea who or what it's about.
Let's go.
But it doesn't, it looks very much like the sports cars that are being made now in the 80s, so it doesn't look particularly unusual to us. I like the all the headlights off down the front. That's kind of neat.
What that funny roll bar?
And the door.
Kind of like the Batman jet thing underneath it.
That car.
Go, Speed Racer.
She looks very uncomfortable.
She sure does. Boy.
Take a picture. Come on. Let's go.
And I think that was the last one.
Oh. I like this one.
Anyway.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, sir.
Sure.
Thanks, Lori. Thank you.
Sorry, too bad you didn't get the last one.
Graduated with distinction in 58. The public eye first fell on him in 1959 when he anonymously entered three different compositions in a competition sponsored by the Youth Circle of the Association of Polish Composers and won the first three prizes.
Wow.
The following year, he won third prize in the Polish Radio's Fiddleberg competition in 1961. His threnody to the victims of Hiroshima was given a mark of recommendation and distinction by UNESCO's Tribute Internationale de Cultures. Apart from the threnody and the St. Luke Passion, his principal works include the Psalm of David for choir and percussion, strophes for soprano, speaker, and 10 instruments, emanations for two-string orchestras, dimensions of time and silence, string quartet, strings of percussion, blah, blah, blah. Lots of Sabbat Mater passion, that kind of thing. The impact of many of his works is due to Penderecki's concern for and acute perception of the texture and very nature of sound. His important experiments in this field and their practical application in his compositions have made him one of the foremost figures in the world of contemporary music. To the victims of Hiroshima, I think it's probably very appropriate here. We're not only talking about death, but with the space shuttle being destroyed and everybody killed, the kind of emotional feel when you see it on TV or some kind of video representation.
Everybody heard this about this.
What?
The space shuttle?
We just heard that the space shuttle blew up and everybody was killed.
Including it was
the when?
Was
this morning.
This morning.
Just this morning.
Along
just
with the
now.
Teacher on it. On what, takeoff?
Along with the teacher.
Along with the teacher.
Is that the one they delayed? With
2 days delay.
Yeah.
So they just.
They know what even anything about what happened.
No, they
Rachel
just found out about it.
Like Rachel said that it was lifting off, and then they had it. When they told them to go to full power or whatever, it exploded.
Ooh. Did they show?
It was on TV, but you'll see it when you get back home. Anyway, the kind of emotion and feeling that you see on the screen when that happens, when that hits you, may bring the reality home. Just as the sound in this music may bring the reality home as well. As an introduction to the sere and brutal world of oral quantum theory, this 9-minute work for 52 string instruments has few equals. The Polish composer's ear for color and texture is as advanced as his mathematics. Knowing the title, one can imagine sirens, screams for the anguished, buzzing airplanes, and the not quite silent calm before the Holocaust, and the dissonant carpet of beating, harmonically generated sound. With another title or without any, the waves and curves of cyclic dimensions revolving around perfect unisons have powerful command over both imagination and intellect. It's a very emotional piece. It can affect people in many different ways. it's also very experimental, so it may not sound like typical music to you. And I think the best way to listen to it is just lying on the floor in the dark. I'm sorry that this record has a slight glitch in it. I think somebody, you know, it's from the library and somebody put the needle across it wrong. So it does have a click. I tried to get another copy, but I just couldn't find another one in the time we had left. So I apologize for that, but you can use your imaginations when you're listening. Kathleen.
Laura's not here right now, but her father was in Hiroshima when the bomb.
Where is Laura? Right?
She doesn't feel very good.
She went to her room.
She told me a little bit about it, and she said that he was 50 miles from where the main went off, and he could hear it, and that was about the extent of it. He couldn't really remember a lot. The aftermath, he could remember, but he could remember hearing it.
Do you know if he talks much about it, Lori's saying?
No, I think she said something that he doesn't talk much about it. But I wonder if that culture too, because she also said that her family was roll call.
Yeah, but they don't talk about that much.
A lot of the victims haven't come out of the closet, so to speak, because they don't want people to know about it. And that's also typical of people who've been through some real traumatic experiences, such as internment camps. They just keep it inside. So, with that introduction, and with the events of the day, and with the further discussion on death,
The movie last night.
Make yourselves comfortable on the floor, please. It's a Ren-O-D is a piece that deals with death to the victims of Hiroshima. And it's 51 string instruments. But it doesn't always sound like an orchestra. Sound in new ways and express his feelings.
Thank you. is a piece about death. Threnody to the victims of Hiroshima.
Threnody?
Todd, do you want to shoot that?
Yeah.
Requiem, concerned with death. People who died. Did you get any feelings or emotions from listening to it? Darren?
I would feel if we were up here at Holden and some bomb went off back in Seattle and we found out that we were the only ones left or something and we went back and our parents and all of our loved ones were gone.
Like that movie, The Day After?
Yeah.
Oh, I felt like I started thinking about, I don't know, I really started feeling the devastation of it, you know. And I started thinking about how I have never been, I mean, nothing bad has ever really happened to me. I mean, I started thinking about the bomb, and then I started thinking about the shuttle, you know, and all the, and then that movie last night hit me the same way. I mean, it's like, I was just so, I don't know how, I couldn't cope with that, because I've never had to deal with that, and I was just struck by it. How hard that would be, and I guess I would, because if I had to, I would have to, and that's what would happen. But it just made me really sad. I don't know, I just felt really empty.
It was almost like at first you could hear kind of in the background the subtle air raid sirens and the sounds of the bombers coming over.
Yeah.
And it seemed, you know, like it was just another air raid, something that people were getting used to. And then all of a sudden, the kind of something was different about it. And then the kind of crescendo where the bomb going off and then the silence for a second afterwards. And then I could just picture stumbling around through the rubble. There was one part in it where there was like a desperation, and I pictured trying to unpile the rocks off, you know, at your home where, you know, your brother or sister or something should be, and desperately trying to get the rocks, and then all of a sudden seeing just, you know, death. They're looking back at you, and the music just kind of,
it made me feel really tense, and I wanted everybody to come around me. I wanted everybody that I knew around me. Two were under a blanket. I wanted just a smash. And then, like, I wanted everybody there so we don't lose them.
I was just saying to Kathleen how I always had this fear that I'll be the one will be left, and I will find my parents or my brother or something. I mean, I'll be the one who will be digging through the rubble like Tom. Oh, and I hate that feeling. I mean, it's like, that's when June said she wanted everyone around, or that's kind of how I feel. I mean, I was thinking, what would I do if, because I come from a place where there's a base too, so whether I'm at PLU or whether I'm home, I'm still ground zero. And so I was thinking, what would I do if our family was told, okay, you know, we're gonna be bombed and everything. What would I do? And I would want my whole family to be together and all of us to. I just always try to imagine what that would be, saying goodbye to your family. And I'd want all of us to be together so we'd all die together, because I wouldn't want to be the one that was left.
Getting ever bigger. So there's a lot going on in this music, and it's not easy to just sit there and listen to it. It's very hard work. Todd, did you want to say anything more about it since you've heard it before?
That's, no, I heard it on a good stereo system in the dark room after just flipping through a bunch of pictures of Hiroshima and time-off books. That's, if you all want to purge your system, good way to do it. It really hits them. And also, I guess it's father was in World War II. And he went into Japan after the bomb had been dropped and he was part of the American army. That's all I know about it. He won't talk about it.
I think that statement is supposed to be taken very literally. When I think back with all the Holocausts that mankind has produced, not just what we did to the Indians or what the Nazis did to the Jews or what we did again to the Japanese or what the Japanese did to us, or you can fill in your blank and just a long litany of it, is everyone allows it to happen. Each one takes responsibility for that because nobody does anything about fighting the real cause, the root cause of what they are. And so in that sense, we all choose it. We all, this very minute, are choosing a nuclear holocaust by the way, the style of lives that we lead and the things that we do. It's true. And to sort of ignore it and pretend that it isn't there is really not taking responsibility. Now, I'm not saying that everyone has to do something or what that something is. It's just to realize that by choosing what you choose, you also choose the world as it exists.
Because you're in it.
Well, I'll argue with you on that just because I feel like, yeah, you can look at that in a broad sense, but I think the way Tom is looking at it, I don't think you can take it literally.
But I think the way Tom is looking at it is precisely the reason why it happens. Because if you look at it as a narrow event, here are these innocent people being bombed by a nuclear weapon, then yeah, right, there is no kind of relationship between these events that means anything. But if you look at it as a broader sense, that
right.
These people are inheritors of what their parents had planted,
right.
then yes, they were responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And we are responsible.
It was a race to develop it as a weapon. What about the so-called survivors? What are some of the problems that the survivors of Hiroshima are facing?
Second generation.
I can't hear what you're saying.
The second generation, because of a lot of radiation that they had, you know, the next generation that came, there was a lot of physical.
All the physical deformities.
And that's been passed down a lot. Emotional scars.
Also, the threat of
what?
Living, like the threat of living in a nuclear age. We do. Could happen again.
Why that amazing guilt of being the only survivor, just like Sophie? You know, just like what you're afraid of.
And your entire family line cut or twisted or...
Yeah, your whole past erased.
I'd feel maybe the opposite if it happened. I would feel that they were better off than me if I was a survivor. I'd feel that they were released, they were done. I guess it may sound selfish, but I'd say why did I survive? I'd rather than die.
Yeah, that's
but
that's torture.
That's what he's supposed to say.
That's what I meant, that I would rather die.
I think I think she agrees.
I think I agree. See, you're both right. Yeah.
So what Lisa said about being a survivor, I have never met someone who hasn't had that fear, and I think it's partly because we can't ever imagine really dying. I mean, we always think we're going to be the minority that survives, uh-huh. Even if...
Something Lori said too about taking responsibility that we're making choices right now that lead us to that is the glory type books on Enola Gay or the Americans, well, it just happened. I mean, it's just something that happened. We have to do. And then a lot of their culture that doesn't talk about it, kind of like a hidden topic.
It's really interesting with all the glory books, and then, you know, you talk about the personal experience of your father, and like a lot of the other people that have been in World War II and things, and they can't even talk about it. And it's the real experience of the war that dramatizes that it was not glory, it was not, you know, it was real. It was pain, it hurt.
Can't think of, when we think of World War II, we think of the Holocaust and the atomic bomb as being the two terrible things that scarred the reputation of the last good war, that there was nothing good at anything. I mean, just, you know, two soldiers, anonymous soldiers in the trenches killing each other is every bit as bad as the dropping of an atomic bomb on innocent people, or, I mean, it's all bad.
Let's move up to the Vietnam War. What was going on with some of those survivors?
We were doing dish team the other day, and we were talking about the Vietnam War. Since like 51,000 soldiers were killed, and since then 51,000 soldiers have committed, Vietnam vets have committed genocide. It's almost equal.
My dad does an extensive amount of work with Vietnam vets. He has groups that he works with. I'd say 75% of the people that call our house, our home phone, are Vietnam vets that he's working with that are just having a hard time. And my mom will sit and argue the fact with my dad for hours about how, you know, the Vietnam War is just an excuse for those vets not to get their life together. And in a way, I mean, if you want, you can look at one aspect of that and say, yeah, but I mean, the devastation of that war and the effect that it had on those men is something that I don't think my mom has a right to judge or that I can even come close to understanding just because I was not there. And I just have seen, my dad has told me a little bit about the work that he does with those men and their families and stuff, and it's just incredible to me that just the head games that, I mean, just the trips that those men were on. I mean, I don't know, it's just the, all the drugs and all the just little tidbits that he has told me about, you know, they have experienced. I mean, he said it would blow me away if I heard what happened in those therapy sessions, what they talk about. And but it's just amazing to me the effect that the wars have men upon
them. One of the things that I've heard in a class, having a couple vets talking and seeing some films, aren't seeing too much, that one of the problems that a lot of the vets are having now is boredom, because they were there and a lot of them thought that it was the best time in their lives over there, because there was excitement. Everything was life or death. There was excitement. Everything was for keeps. And they get back here and, you know, it's the big thing, you know, I mean, excitement, whether you'll get a job to be able to get a car or something, and there's just not that life or death type excitement anymore, and they're just so bored they can't stand it. And that's just another side that a lot of them I've heard about, but I can't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
from the ISP War class. I read a book called Rumors of War by Frank Caputo. Philip? And he speaks in there of when you're, and we talked about this in class, when you're in war, you have your senses are just sharp. You have enlightened senses. Things are just really sharp, and you're really always on this kind of emotional high edge, and everything's so clear because you do have that life or death feeling.
And also, a lot, since you're so vulnerable, you're a lot more deeper in everything about you. This could be this coming from the same past and everything, the same camaraderie, the world, you know, the friendships and such, but also the hurts and pains. Another good movie that, like Sophie's Choice, is The Deer Hunter.
So outside of the fact that war causes death, what does this have to do with death in our own lives, our own personal lives, our own little personal lives? What does this have to do with it?
What does war have to do with?
What does all that we're discussing?
It makes me aware of how afraid I am of it, how much I fear it, how much I will do anything to avoid it, how much it confuses me because I don't understand it. It's something that I can't grasp, and I always put it so far in the future. I mean, it's like it's not reality for me.
And also about how little we actually care about unless it affects ourselves or maybe the people immediately around us. But it just seems maybe it's because people fear it so much that they don't think about it that hardened to it, or what? But we really just even thinking about the Holocaust or Hiroshima, you would think something like that would just devastate everybody, but it really doesn't.
How do you bring it
up? I don't know if it's exactly how it relates to us, but I'm just thinking about how society, maybe through TV and everything, portrays this, that, man, people get killed in front of me every day. They say 7 people got killed in Shuttle. I'm like, oh. I mean, it doesn't, I have to work to have it faze me, but if they told you that, there was some affair happening between some famous person, that'd be such a bigger deal, or that it's like they make killing fine right in front of you, but something like sex, they can't put it on a TV, they can't put it on a magazine cover, they can't put it because that's bad. But killing, hell, they can put, 30 people taking purple lemonade and killing them, dying on the front of a Time cover, and they can say, dying so for other people, it just happens all the time. It doesn't affect us. I don't know why.
But what are our attitudes toward death? Go ahead.
I just want to say that we depersonalize it, and it's just like when I learned in psych class about war. When you're out there, you don't look at the other guy that you're shooting at as a person, but as the other, the the other side, you know, not, you understand what I'm saying? You depersonalize them so there's no feeling there. But I think if you were told that, yeah, your best friend was on a space shuttle or it was your parents, you know, immediately I think you would get a reaction. But you just depersonalize it.
Let's talk about what our attitudes toward death are.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. Both of those comments are real perfect.
I feel like maybe we have a double standard for death, in a way. It's like, you know, we read about in a newspaper or hear on the TV or radio, and, you know, 20 people killed in a blaze in Cincinnati, you know. It just really doesn't, just a headline to us. And yet, someone close to us was to die, it affects our whole life. Or, and then when we even think about our own, we're afraid. Because almost the more personal it gets, the more fear and emotion is heightened.
We've lost sight of the connection between all of humanity. Instead of, you know, like Jung says and Christ, that we're all part of the same body, or they're all one, it's kind of evolved into, well, there's this family group or this group of friends and this, and they're all scattered about, and if one of them is wiped out, it doesn't seem to affect you. Only a part of your own is. We've lost the sense of it, lost the sense of a global community.
Well, how do we as individuals respond and react to death? Not just the trauma of experiencing it when it happens, but what are our attitudes about it? How do we deal with it in our regular lives? Yes, Annette?
I think sometimes we don't want to.
Okay, so avoiding the whole issue is one of the ways. Yeah.
I tend to harden myself to it, you know, to kind of protect my little shell, my little world. You know, I'll take it in, but I won't let it affect me. And I kind of like try to put into a frame of reference like, oh, everybody's going to die, you know, too bad. It's kind of, I mean, I don't really take it that, you know, easy, but it's kind of my way of, if I take it light, it's my way of not getting mad.
Are we repressing feelings we should have? I don't know if I feel I should have feelings for them, but maybe that's something that we do so we can just push it out of our mind and not have one. Real mourning or sorrow for everybody, maybe. I don't know. It's an easy way out, maybe. I don't know what would be.
So what you're saying is that you don't see any other option? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that maybe that's what we're doing, but I don't know what, in my rational mind, would be what's the, you know, point? I'm not going to suffer for these people that I don't know, you know, that if it's going to hurt me and make me unhappy, you know, why should I force myself to do it?
Why do you have to force yourself? What happens when somebody forces you? You're not going to force it then. It's going to come pretty natural.
June, did you have something?
Yeah, I guess I'm not afraid of my own death. I'm probably scared of death. I am scared of the moments before, if there's going to be any pain involved. I'm more scared of that than actual dying. But it'd be harder for me to watch somebody else die, somebody really close to me. Mm-hmm. It would rank on me that really bad. But my own death would be, you know, it's okay, guys, it's cool. Go on, leave me, I'm okay, you know, get on with your own lives. But to watch somebody else die.
I'm trying to understand is what we inherit, what attitudes about death are we given. I'm not trying to judge them, I'm just trying to understand them.
Death is bad, but we also have to believe that death is good. I mean, it's kind of, you know, well, when you die, you can go to heaven. So that's good. But dying is bad. And you don't know what to think about it.
Why is it bad?
I don't know. I'm a bit nervous. everybody says death is bad, try to avoid it.
Christine, I sort of learned from my family that for the person who dies, they're going to have peace, but it's us that have the turmoil and the loss of the person, and it's us that have the problem, but the person that dies, what eventually after we're done grieving, perhaps over the person's death, we find peace in our minds knowing that they're happy where they're at and that they have peace.
Maybe someone talks and we'll talk. I've lost it for you. I got it. Oh, okay. I don't know, I think it just passed. But anyway, maybe it's, we're not totally, I'm talking of our own death, 100% scared of our own death, but maybe, I mean, the actual death, I forget the pain and stuff, but maybe we're scared of it coming before we're ready. Before we're ready, if we believe in God, ready to meet Him, we're ready, being that we're not done trying to be successful or reaching our goals that we've made in life or reaching out to someone we were trying to reach out to. And then we're scared of not being able to finish before the book's closed.
So we, not only are we, is death bad, is to be avoided, are we afraid of it, we're to delay it as well.
Did somebody else have their hand up before me?
I think Todd wanted to say something.
Oh, it was interesting to me, and I don't know why. I'm kind of more asking than I am making a statement, but I'm curious as to why I feel like if I were told tomorrow that I had leukemia or cancer or something, I was going to die like within a year, I would feel really like I have to do all these things, a lot of things that I'd want to get done, you know, before I die. But when because I am not faced with that, I feel like I should be doing more or something, like now when it's not a crisis, like I should try to live each day as much as I possibly can and get the most out of it. But I don't feel that need. I feel like I'm lazy or something now because I'm not scared about my own death. You know, it's so far in the future, I can just put it off or whatever. And I'm just wondering if anybody else feels that way. Mm-hmm.
Why not live everything you want to do anyway?
That's what I'm asking. I mean, I'm asking myself, why don't I just live that way, whether I know I'm going to die tomorrow or whether it's in 80 years, but I don't know why I don't. Yeah. I feel like I lack motivation or something, you know?
I find it interesting that people, I don't think of it as delaying death. That seems to be a real pessimistic way of doing it, but instead just living life instead.
Living life.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think of it as pushing it off. You don't really want to die because, you know, hopefully you're enjoying yourself, but, you know, you're living life while it's there. And,
I think he kind of just talked. I just wanted to ask what Kai thought about it, because I just noticed how the differences in the way that we live while we're here. I feel like during this month that we're here, Kai just wants to get totally, absolutely everything out of the time while he's here, because he hardly ever sleeps and he's always doing things all the time, and some of the rest of us are more relaxed and stuff, and I wondered if he'd say something about that, but he just didn't.
Dave and Annette.
Okay, I was just gonna say, I think one of my biggest fears of death is that besides maybe committing suicide, I don't have any other control over it. Not like I have, I mean, I didn't have control over my birth either, but, you know, if I get some disease, I can't control it unless I get medicine or something for it. But, you know, I can't say, again, like if I commit suicide or something, which I'm not going to do, I don't have any control of when it's going to happen or how it's going to happen.
There's a lot of people who, even within the context of contemporary Christian America, would completely disagree with what you said, which is sort of interesting. I don't necessarily. I'm just saying that there are a lot of people who feel that disease is, in fact,
product of our attitudes about ourselves or minds or Christian scientists are one of them. Naturopathic medicine addresses another one. There's an awful lot of interesting research about the power we have over our body. That's an interesting point about what we feel about death, about not being able to choose.
Maybe a word that would encompass what we were talking about was sort of the mystery of it.
This would kind of in lieu or whatever the word is to Denise's talk about how fast you're doing things and which maybe it's, you know, we kind of try to push this view of death out of our minds and we say, well, shoot, I could take my time. I've got a long time to live, you know, if you haven't been told that you're going to die next week or whatever. And so, hey, I can take my time because I can do that 5 years from now and I can get that in the next 10 years and that's great. You know, and I think that has a lot to do with how fast we go about doing what we're trying to do.
What I think sometimes is just, I mean, I'm afraid of death. And that sometimes it scares me. Being afraid of death scares me because I think, well, if I'm afraid of dying, if I'm afraid of something as wonderful as being released to heaven, then something must be wrong with my faith. And you're kind of going, well, I mean, because if you go up to God, you know, and you're afraid, well, then obviously something's wrong. But I think I just thought about it a few minutes just now, and, you know, won't God understand that fear? I mean, he understands everything else about us. Once you also understand that fear that we have.
Yep. Paul, would you like to join our circle? We could make room for you.
Yeah, I'm here. I will. Thank you.
You know, you're welcome.
We're talking about sort of the big D when we're talking about death. And I think one of the things that we try and look at what the hidden messages in our culture about what death is like. It's a lot easier to look at little D's and see how we deal with the little D's to understand what some of those subliminal things are. So I guess what I want to know is what are some of the reactions that you guys have to what are the metaphorical deaths in our lives? I mean, of course, we all have ideas and ideals and we have beliefs. What I'm actually talking about are not those, but how they really affect you, what your real deep down reaction is to them.
Little death, break of relationships.
Okay, but what are your attitudes to it? How do you respond? What's your modus operandi?
What's that mean?
How do you operate? What is your mode of operation?
Try to numb yourself up. Try to tell yourself that it doesn't matter, and you try to prepare yourself for the worst, but inside you know, dang it, that it does matter, and you're hurting like hell. And did I give you, I mean, you try to deal with it, but then there's a part of you that's saying, you can't, honey. And I remember myself yesterday trying to not cry, just, I'm not gonna cry, mind over matter, and kept on pouring, you know. And it's like too conflicting, I don't know.
Okay, so what basically you're saying is that it's something that's going to be so painful that you want to avoid it if you can, just like you're talking about.
You want to take control.
Gild your loins against the pain. Good. Lisa. Gird your loins.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. When you have a last name of Gold, you say things that are very strange.
I think that was.
I was just thinking along the same lines of breakup of, you know, especially relationships or something. I always try to be the one who does the hurting when I know I'm going to be hurt. I always try to be the first one to the gun, so to speak. If I know that if I know that a relationship isn't going to work, I want to be the one to end it. Or I want the control because I don't want to be the one who has to think, you know, it was my fault or whatever. I want to be the one to say,
okay.
I don't know, I want to have control.
I want to talk
not,
about that.
Not be a fault.
But, go ahead.
I think that's just like the wanting to be the first one to die because you don't want to be the one to deal with the hurt.
Okay, so what is that saying? What is the implication of that statement then?
I don't want to take responsibility.
Or we want to avoid.
You don't want to feel the pain. You want to avoid it.
You want to run away from
it. It's okay for the other guy to move or not.
What does that mean when if you spend a lot of time in your life avoiding pain, running away from pain, trying not to be hurt? What happens to your life when you do that?
Miss all opportunities.
You miss something. What else happens besides
you? Don't take risks.
I don't think you grow.
You don't grow.
You don't grow. Okay.
Well, and it's always, I mean, once you start running away from something, it starts chasing you. It's always that.
Yeah, you don't learn to honor it.
Unless you can deal with something, it's going to stay there. Something just doesn't go away. If something dies, you don't just
pretend it's still there.
Yeah, it's still, when you avoid the pain, it's still there. You aren't dispersing it or making it go away. You're just pretending it's not there.
So do you think that sometimes when you avoid pain in relationships, you unconsciously, or because of not growing, seek other relationships that will likely to cause the same kind of pain? Is that part of what you're saying? Maybe.
Could be. I wasn't thinking along that.
What does that imply? If in a sense, by avoiding the pain starts chasing you, what does that imply in terms of avoiding the big D or avoiding confronting the big D? What do you think that might mean?
It kind of reminds me of the song that we heard yesterday by the Sparrow about, she kind of ran away from it, you know, but it was always, there are always these people there, and then she kind of turned around and it was there. I don't know, it seems like if you could just turn around and say hello to it, then you could, then it could go leave too.
Okay, I saw Kai's first, then I know that Brent and Meg, Jeanette, did you have your hand up there?
No, just
Kathleen. And Kathleen, okay.
I don't know, I'm real conscious of it. If you don't face it, it grows bigger than the avalanche, and then it bites. I mean, I see that real because of my parents' divorce, that it was really great, and if there were little things that bothered one or the other, but instead they thought that because of their love that they, you know, put up with it for the other person, and it built up to a point where you can't understand why you can't work it out. And I think that happens all the time. And we were talking last night that you can't have a life without a crisis now. You know, that's something to think about. If you don't know how to face them, it's scary.
I don't know, when you said something, Laura, you sparked something in me. It was like, wow, revelation. No.
Uh-huh.
It's like,
yeah, quick.
It's like our breaking up a relationship in a way is a metaphor for death. And I'm trying to think why. That's kind of what I heard you asking, was why. And I guess because it's like when you move away from hometown or you move away from your friends and you break up a relationship, you're hurt because you're not with that person anymore. And it's like when I look back, like when my grandfather died or my grandma or my pet cat, you know, it's like I feel like it's a break of a relationship. I'm not able to be with them anymore. And I cry for myself because I'm not able to have them anymore. And at the same time, there's people around to comfort me, but who's to comfort the person that died? It almost sounds like it's lonely to be dead. Like, I'm here, I'm with my mom, my dad, and I'm with these people here to comfort me and be with me still. The person that died is gone by themselves. And they're gone. I don't know. And then if I reverse that and say to myself, does that mean that when I die, that I'm going to be alone? That's part of it.
Go ahead. I have something else, so I'm going to answer to what I was thinking of when Brent was talking. I don't think of death that way, as being lonely. Ever since I was little, I always thought, oh, when I die, I'm going to get all my answers to all my questions. I get to see, you know, all these relatives my mom talks about. So I don't think of it as being so lonely. And I haven't had much experience with people I've ever felt close to dying.
except for my grandma, and I really wasn't that sad, because you're supposed to die when you get old, and it's real different. But the reason I raised my hand was about being chased or whatever. I was thinking, when you're being chased, you're always thinking of ways to avoid it, and you're really concentrating on it more, a lot more, and being obsessed with it than it.
Very good point.
Plus, you always get caught.
Well, the thing I was going to say is that, what is the nature of obsession then? What happens to the life you lead if you're obsessed by something?
That's control. The obsession controls.
And so you deal with it, yeah, in more increasingly direct but increasingly overwhelming ways.
But also, it may mean that you can't experience all the other things as fully as you might. I know when I'm avoiding things and I feel pain, I'm blocking out a lot of the other stuff that's going on, because all my energy's focused because the pain is chasing me. So I get apathetic because I'm blocking. So life is boring. I don't feel as much.
I don't know which one of you guys are first.
I don't know, I had something that triggered me from Meg that I remember from last night. I don't know if it doesn't really have to do exactly with death, but helped me understand, or was an idea for the whole class kind of thing, was she said, well, when I'm going to have all the answers or something like that, that the thing the one line I got out of the movie while I was sitting there knitting was that if you find truth, truth isn't any easier to understand. And I think that that's something to think about, that even if we hear the right answers, we're not going to understand them any better than the wrong answers. And so that's something I thought was interesting.
That's a good observation.
It goes along with what Max was saying, and what Lori was saying about, well, first it started, I thought it started when he mentioned about running away from, you know, one kind of relationship, you seek other relationships like that. And I think about, for myself, I'll be transferring next year, and I think, well, I'm leaving PLU, and I kind of at times want to say, well, you know, I could stay at PLU and get a different degree, you know, because it's like a wonderful place. But then I think, you know, well, when I go to Oregon State, I'll be getting more, if I go to Oregon State, I'll be getting, you know, the real world, more of, you know, all these things, and I'm kind of at the same time excited and not looking forward to it, but I am. And that same sort of thing with relationships, with death. And also I thought about Lydia riding away from Goldman on the horse, and how she was galloping away as fast as she could, but then she just kind of stopped. And kind of like Goldman was death flirting with us, we run away from it, but at the same time we're wanting it and expecting it. And I don't know, that just kind of...
I think it's a marvelous point that kind of dovetails with what Meg was saying. And I think in some ways you're right about death, as we have a preoccupation with it is... if you're sort of obsessed by it in a way, wanting it, and it's in an odd sort of way, and being afraid of that, but not being able to address those issues in a real conscious kind of accepting way, what happens then? If you can't bring them up in the open, where do they have to go? And what happens to them when they're there? Well, it seems like what your unconscious mind is always showing you what your conscious mind doesn't want to see. So if you accept that premise, then how does it show us?
Dreams.
Pardon me?
Dreams.
Dreams might be one way. But how does it show in behavior?
Self-destructive behavior.
What do you think? Okay, Marty.
I've got a couple good examples of that death wish behavior. Where my best dog was up hunting, and this hunter shot him, so I wanted immediately to get revenge. So I went after that guy and had a little brawl with him. I wanted revenge for that death to my friend. That was
incredible. How is that like death wish, Marty?
Just like I wanted to fight back for that what happened.
You wanted to kill something else.
Hurt it or
strike on it.
Do you think that maybe you'd get hurt in the process?
I didn't care.
A lot of the majority of the people I work with and hotel died this summer, the ones that could resolve, go through the process, face the fear, had far more peaceful deaths than the, especially the men that would keep denying it and denying it. You'd see a lot of self-destructive behavior, purposely taking off their oxygen and being miserable, purposely refusing morphine coding, you know?
And I think to bring it down to the little desk, the relationships, a lot of us relive the same kind of relationships because we aren't facing consciously what we're doing in our relationships. So we kind of deny and goes down into a lot of self-destructiveness in those as well. And it's not only death, but it's the little deaths that we, if we deny the way those men did, we're taking off our oxygen from one of our strong needs, and that is to connect with other people and have intimacy.
Annette? Something just came to me kind of listening to you. You know, like, you don't want to be hurt, and you're preparing yourself, and you're trying to avoid the hurt or whatever, but there's something you can learn out of it. And so then, but if you try to avoid this hurt and everything, you don't learn from it, then all of a sudden you get, maybe a year later, you let yourself, and you get into a new relationship, and maybe it's going to end up breaking the same way because you didn't learn from the last what you could have, and that way maybe you've made that one better.
Yeah.
So you need to grab a hold. I guess it's like a dragon. You need to befriend that pain, that hurt.
But yeah, because it's not the person that you're relating to that's causing those things. It's the person you were with before or the person you were before. And so it's chasing you.
I got another experience I just remembered when I was in Spain and there was an avalanche about 2 feet from me and I almost died there. And I had like flashbacks of what my life was about. So went down and I heard on the radio that this other ski resort across the way, 6 people had just died in an avalanche there. They closed down this lift I was on because of this avalanche. So I was going to either go hide and cover myself up and not think about it or face it. So I went right back up the next ski lift and went skiing again and just kind of forgot it and just went after it. And if I hadn't done that, I think I would have hid myself somewhere and just not faced anything, just kind of been scared of life.
Yeah.
What do you think we do as a culture to manifest or to our behavior that talks about our fear of death? How does our culture manifest? Yes,
well, this might be part of it. I know that thinking for self is immortal. I know myself, I'm halfway between the youthful belief that I'm immortal and the realization of death.
So the eternal youth syndrome, is that sort of what you're talking about?
Well, thinking, well, it won't happen to me, at least for a long time. Denying it.
And there's so much in our culture that's stay young, stay beautiful, beautiful and young is the way to be. And don't let yourself deteriorate. And
okay.
Yeah.
It stinks.
Michelle and then Tom.
I was just thinking, I had a friend that I was really close to growing up, and in sixth grade we kind of fell apart, and I don't know her very well at all anymore. I see her once in a while, but in sixth grade it wasn't because of this, it was because I never saw her anymore, but in sixth grade she found out that she had diabetes. And she had to take insulin and everything. I guess it was really bad. And she really was frustrated with that. She used to tell herself every morning that she wished she were dead. She hated herself. She kept saying, why me? And it was like a year later in seventh grade, and I hadn't seen her a lot because we then went to different schools, and but we still lived close to each other, and she was with some other friends, and they were driving down the street, well, with a friend and her dad, and something happened to the car, and they got out of the car, and I guess they were walking, like, up the hill or something back toward their house, because it wasn't very far from their houses, and the dad had gone around the fence, and the engine exploded or something, and he wasn't killed or anything, he was burned pretty bad, but she was just thinking, you know, she had stayed in the car, and like all of a sudden, it was so real, and she was scared. She came running to my house crying, and it was weird because I wasn't like a person anymore. But it was like, you know, she had said this all the time. She wished she was dead, and all of a sudden, it was like she could have died. I mean, it could have been real, and she was scared to death. And it's just weird.
Yeah.
Lori was asking what society does. It's also given us so many, society now, there's so many ways to die. I mean, it just seems like they invent a new way to die every day. Maybe it's part of the obsession with it. Earlier I was thinking about, I've never seen this, I've just heard about a videotape called The Basis of Death. Something which is just an hour, 2 hour videotape showing all different kinds of death, everywhere from slaughtering animals to just all different kinds of death. And it's just kind of, it's just hard to figure out what this.
You mean it's almost glamorized?
We seem to be really entrenched in the whole death thing, really fascinated by it. Of slowing down when you see an accident, or ambulance,
mm-hmm.
going and seeing these things happen, or
like me
just the violence
footage of the shuttle exploding.
The violence on in our entertainment.
So the death is the violence that we see. I mean, it's not.
So our fear of death then gives us a fascination by violence. That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. But it occurs by violence on the screen.
I'm not sure I understand.
Hello.
It's not the peacefulness that Meg was talking about that we see on the videos.
So we are fascinated by the violence.
The violence and the death and violence are intertwined, okay. I think. In our culture, not in other cultures, mm-hmm. but in our culture.
This made me think of what was just said. This came off of it or something. Like when we stop by a car accident or something, okay? We want to know more about death. But then again, we'll take chances to get a little closer to see it, but we don't want it too close. Okay, we don't want it, there's a mystery to it. We want to understand that, we want to be able to organize it and categorize it or whatever and break it down. But then if it gets too close, we don't want it because we're still scared.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit. We're getting a little bit on, and there's a couple of points I kind of want to
make.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand up.
It's okay. I was just kind of spinning off our society's views about death. It's like we have to battle death. It's like, we have to use our science, our technology, use doctors and, everybody, seatbelts, mothers against drunk driving, all those things with battle death. So that more people can live. And yet, at the same time, we reap other things like crime, drug use, wars. And I don't know, I see it as just an ongoing battle that's never gonna win. And in the same way, in our society, my dad sells life insurance. And basically, what he's doing is he's helping people to bet on how long people are going to live, in a way. And, every insurance agent knows what the average longevity of people are in America. It's like, I think, 65 or 70. It's around there. It fluctuates. But if you go to, this is what I heard, anyway, that if you go to, some of the, even some of, Eastern Bloc countries, where life is very subdued. They don't have the technology. They don't have the, it's a very simple type of lifestyle. They have people that are living up to 110, you know, and it, the longevity is a lot higher. And yet they're not, they don't have all the technology and science trying to battle death. It's just interesting, the paradox, I guess.
I was going to say, kind of another extreme of that that I've seen in media and books lately is that, like, the war aid come out, let's make a profit off it, it's going to happen, so let's have black market livers. Like, well, it's lost here on Earth, so let's plan for moving to a different planet and we'll escape it that way.
I don't understand.
Could you explain? There's a ward 8 where really young people go into surgery and they switch the gas lines, and so the people accidentally die, they just don't know how, and then the book cover has the people on strings, perfect life balance, and then when they need a heart or a liver, people just call over a phone and they just kill that person.
I was thinking that do we view death as most of our, or we're talking about death and as violent death. And I think we think more of death as violence instead of, that we're going to die violently instead of just dying in our sleep type idea.
Uh-huh. Or slowly.
We do that fearing the before the death part. I mean, like the pain that you might go through or trauma.
That might be protracted or drawn out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, too, that our fear of death is manifest in ways that we really have no idea of. One of them, a couple of them I'd like to share with you. I think the reason that we have raped the earth and poisoned it is because we're afraid of death. And I'll make that connection if I can. That because we're afraid of death, we never like to realize that we are part of a cycle. That is to say, we don't realize that we ourselves are going to die at some point and that the world will continue on. Because we don't address the fact that we are part of that cycle, we deny that it exists. If we deny that it exists, then our perspective on how we deal with the world is very narrow. Narrow enough to deal with either our own lifetimes or even narrow segments of our lifetime. What that means then is that we can go into any part of the environment of the earth and take what we want because we want it, not even considering what we might be doing to the earth for the generations that follow us. Another part of that, which is the paradox that Brent is talking about, is our fear of death also means we're fascinated by it. So we are in that love-hate relationship, which means we constantly delay it by inventing technology that will keep people alive, even if they're uncomfortable and in miserable shape, far beyond where their body would prefer to be. At the same time, we create the great machines of war that help then create greater and more thorough and significant ways of making death. At the same time, we create an artificial heart. We have nuclear weapons and incredible jet planes.
And the birth rate can go up because we have technology to help more babies be born.
And the other side of that is that there are people who really hate the idea of abortion, yet at the same time, how much are they dedicating to helping the lives of the people that are alive? And at one point, it's immoral to kill. On another thing, it doesn't seem to be moral to help those who are living have a better life. I'm not arguing one or the other. I'm pointing the paradoxes that exist. Consequently, I think our fear of death is something, or our lack of acceptance of death, which comes.